DBHDD has an urgent warning for all Georgians. One of every 10 counterfeit pills contains fentanyl, a powerful and very deadly drug. Pills from friends or dealers are unsafe, and one pill can cause an overdose. More info at opioidresponse.info.
Hello and welcome to the Georgia Today podcast. Here we bring you the latest reports from the GPB newsroom. On today's episode, the Atlanta City Council calls for stricter guidelines around high-speed police chases, the accused Appalachian High School shooter appears in court, and a Georgia political strategist weighs in on what Governor Brian Kemp's decision not to run for U.S. Senate could mean for the midterm elections.
If he had decided to be the nominee, it would have been an extremely competitive race with incumbent Senator Ossoff. More of a toss-up now, not knowing who the GOP nominee will be.
Today is Tuesday, May 6th. I'm Orlando Montoya, and this is Georgia Today. Governor Brian Kemp announced yesterday that he will not make a run for the U.S. Senate in 2026. His decision sets off what's likely to be a competitive Republican race, with multiple candidates seeking to take on the incumbent Democratic U.S. Senator John Ossoff. The GOP considers Ossoff to be a top target in the midterms. Here to talk about what this decision might mean is longtime Georgia political strategist and commentator Bill Crane. Thanks for joining me today.
Good to be with you.
Governor Kemp wrote in his statement yesterday that running would be, quote, not the right decision for me and my family. Do you think this was a personal and family decision, or at least partly political?
I think a majority family decision. His wife, First Lady Marty Kemp, is probably his closest personal friend and advisor. They have three daughters, one of whom just got married. The other two are not far behind in that regard. I know Marty's already thinking and picturing grandchildren. The idea of living in Washington was never something that the Kemp family was all that enamored of. Governor Kemp also prefers the executive model. He served in the state Senate, but he felt like he was more effective as Secretary of State, certainly as governor. And then in the private sector, previously he was a home builder and developer. So he's very much used to being kind of in charge. So I do think it was more driven by personal factors. Politically speaking, I think if he had decided to be the nominee, it would have been an extremely competitive race with incumbent Senator Ossoff. More of a toss-up now, not knowing who the GOP nominee will be and knowing that it'll be a very spirited primary, both for Senate and the governor's race, and not having Governor Kemp on the ballot at all, nor Donald Trump, may impact turnout for Republicans.
There's a long list of potential Republican candidates who could step into this race to challenge Senator Ossoff. Can you talk about who they are and which voters they might animate in the GOP?
Among the more polarizing candidates, but who will also have both a financial base, name ID, and a draw, Marjorie Taylor Greene. She's already been looking at the race. Then former U.S. Senator, now Small Business Administrator, Kelly Loeffler is looking at making a runoff or attempt at the race, and she bested John Ossoff in the general election but didn't win outright and then lost to him in the runoff. John King, the state's insurance commissioner, who's also the first statewide Latino elected official, is eyeing the race, as is Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger. So we have two constitutional officers with some statewide name ID, Congressman Mike Collins, Congressman Buddy Carter down of the 1st Congressional District down on the coast, and Dr. and Congressman Rich McCormick, who's an MD, who is one of two practicing doctors in Congress who represents the 6th Congressional District.
John Ossoff's campaign manager wrote in response to yesterday's decision that, quote, Senator Ossoff is well prepared to defeat any challenger, but as a Democrat in a state that Trump won in 2024, is he vulnerable?
He is vulnerable. I think he's one of the most vulnerable Democratic incumbents in the U.S. Senate. But part of that vulnerability, he's very good at constituent services. He's very good at reaching out across the aisle and being a pragmatic politician sometimes as it results in actual legislation, not just bombast and talk in front of a microphone in the U.S. Senate. But he has injured his own relationships with a couple of key constituencies within the Democratic Party. His positions on the war in Israel with Hamas have disappointed some in the Jewish community. Senator Ossoff himself is Jewish. And even though it was intended as a private conversation, he reached out to Nkema Williams, the 5th District Congresswoman and then chair of the Democratic Party, after the results of November's 2022's election, or 2024's election, and sort of expressed some disappointment in the way some resources were deployed here in Georgia and questioned if a person should be holding elective office, in this case, a congressional seat, and chairing the party, if that was a good idea. Congresswoman Williams decided to go public with that expression of dissent. And so you had one of our two United States senators questioning the leadership of an African-American female who chairs the party and who is the congressional representative of our capital city and the largest constituency the Democratic Party needs for enthusiastically turning out in a general election are African-American women. So I think there's time for him to heal those wounds. And he's certainly trying to do that with some of his direct mail and campaign fundraising literature in terms of the issues he's speaking to. But in politics, sometimes bruised egos last longer than they might should. And I don't know if they'll have all of that healed by the fall of 26.
Georgia political strategist and commentator Bill Crane, thanks for your expertise and your being with us today. Thank you very much.
Take care.
The Atlanta City Council is calling for stricter guidelines around the Georgia State Patrol's high-speed chases within the city. GPB's Amanda Andrews reports the suggested policies are aimed at saving lives.
The recommended changes include restricting chases to instances of violent felonies, requiring supervisor approval, and banning pit maneuvers in densely populated areas. Reporting from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution found more than half the GSP's 6,700 chases ended in a crash. Kate Shankey spoke at the meeting about her son, Cooper, a bystander who was killed in a state patrol chase in April.
It could have been a family going to Target, but 80 miles an hour down that road, heavily populated, it's not the first time this has happened. I'd love it to be the last.
Council has called on the Atlanta police chief to return within 60 days to report on policy changes they've made for working with GSP. For GPB News, I'm Amanda Andrews.
A Georgia State Senator representing a district north of Atlanta traveled to Savannah yesterday to announce he's running for lieutenant governor. GPB's Benjamin Payne reports on the candidacy of Sandy Springs Democrat Josh McLaurin.
Standing along River Street with the port of Savannah looming in the background, McLaurin said next year's race would serve as a referendum on the Trump administration, especially its policy of tariffs.
Savannah, Georgia is the front line in the war that Georgia should be fighting against these senseless tariffs. But right now, our state leaders are doing anything but stand up to Trump's tariffs. If anything, they are sucking up to Trump and trying to pretend that everything that he's doing is hunky-dory.
The Port of Savannah is the East Coast's second busiest port, which McLaurin said sources roughly a third of its imports from China. Goods from that country are currently subject to a 145% levy under Trump's tariff policy, which McLaurin called a, quote, needless tax on consumers and working people. For GPB News, I'm Benjamin Payne in Savannah.
The Appalachee High School student accused of shooting and killing two teachers and two students was in court this morning. His attorney seemed to indicate his client could plead guilty later in the fall. GPB's Chase McGee has more.
Defense attorney Alfonso Kraft told Barrow County Superior Court Judge Nick Prim that Colt Gray could be ready for a plea hearing in October after a report from a psychologist was completed. Earlier, state attorneys asked if the defense was ready to schedule a non-negotiated plea where Gray would admit guilt to the shooting, but sentencing would remain up to the judge. Judge Prim also noted that the plea would not conflict with his father, Colin Gray's, trial for providing the rifle used in the shooting.
I think the October timing works well because Colin Gray's trial is scheduled in September, and in order to avoid any publicity tainting that trial, it makes sense to do the plea after.
It's unclear if Colt Gray would face a sentence with or without possibility of parole, but as a juvenile, he will not receive the death penalty. For GPB News, I'm Chase McGee in Winder.
Prominent civil rights attorney Ben Crump is filing a lawsuit against a former Florida sheriff's deputy and others for last year's shooting death of a 23-year-old airman from Atlanta. U.S. Senior Airman Roger Fortson was shot and killed at the back door of Fortson's apartment in Fort Walton Beach, Florida. The lawsuit alleges that the deputy used excessive deadly force when he shot Fortson within seconds of the door opening. The deputy was fired after an investigation concluded his life was not in danger when he shot Fortson. Atlanta has returned to clearing homeless encampments after a 45-day moratorium. City officials temporarily halted clearings after a city crew using heavy construction equipment fatally crushed a man during a January sweep of one encampment. The death of Cornelius Taylor sparked outrage in the community. Crews using earth-moving equipment yesterday cleared tents and other items used by dozens of unhoused people under Interstate 20 near downtown.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money Podcast from NPR.
Georgia taxpayers contributed more than $74 million to rural hospitals last year as part of a state tax credit program. The State Department of Audits and Accounts reported the numbers yesterday. 34 of the 54 eligible hospitals received more than $1 million each. The General Assembly launched the tax credit program in 2017, allowing taxpayers to reduce their state income tax liability by the amounts they donate. The amount goes to hospitals in counties with populations of 50,000 or fewer. In 2023, hospitals reported that most of the money they received through the program was spent on capital projects or regular operating expenses. Among the ideas in President Trump's proposed federal budget is completely ending the National Endowment for the Humanities. The NEH already has seen its $200 million allotment zeroed out by the administration's Department of Government Efficiency. That's money used to support arts and culture in all 50 states, including Georgia. GPB's Grant Blankenship has more.
Mado, thank you for that welcoming.
From a podium in the volleyball gym at Middle Georgia State University in Macon, former U.S. Poet Laureate Joy Harjo.
I want to give you this as it was given to me.
Reads.
Gifts of inspiration often come when we don't expect it, when we need it.
And when she's done, the nation's first Native American poet laureate takes questions from the audience, like this one from Howard High School student Sol Harmon. If you had a biopic, what would it be called?
So it would be maybe Dancing with My Mother in the Kitchen. That would be it. And what about you?
And with that, a question becomes a conversation.
And I've written this poem called Weeping Willow. So it'll probably be like that. Like, it's how it's like beauty, but it went through a journey, so. Yeah.
Oh, cool. Mm-hmm. My mother wrote a song called Weeping Willow.
Oh, that's dope.
Yeah, yeah. She did. And she wrote on this album.
The two of them? They really connect. Sol felt it.
I felt like we was vibing, yeah.
Sol says this morning she was done with poetry after Weeping Willow. It was just too painful. But after talking to Joy Harjo.
Poetry, it really is dear to me, so I guess that might be a segue.
This may have changed your life.
Yeah, absolutely.
She says she wasn't expecting that on a Thursday. Mary McCartan Wern says that was the plan all along.
I worked very hard to get those students into that room because they don't know they want to be there till they get there.
Wern is the new president of the Georgia Humanities Council, the nonprofit which, alongside the college and other partners, brought Harjo here.
What we are is we're connectors and conveners.
That takes money. When DOGE zeroed out the budget for the National Endowment for the Humanities, that took Georgia Humanities' annual operating budget of about $1.5 million with it. That's about 15 cents per Georgian per year.
Overnight, we lost all of that money.
Some of which they've spent, but now they won't be reimbursed for. Like for the annual National History Day, where young people from across the state present research projects.
Now, my name is Chester Davis.
And to help resurrect voices from the past.
And we will welcome you to the Hay House.
That's a recording from 1979 of Chester Davis, the first tour docent at Macon's opulent Civil War-era Italian-style mansion, the Hay House, owned by the Georgia Trust for Historic Preservation. Davis was a driver for the home's owner before he was a tour guide. Hay House director Aubrey Newby says it took about a decade to get the literal proof of the lives of the African Americans like Davis who made this house run out of storage and on full display, which
would probably not have happened had the Georgia Humanities grant not been available to us.
Not a big grant, $2,500. Lots of small museums have seen help like that across the state for almost 55 years. And McCleary has seen it in her work with Georgia Humanities, bringing Smithsonian exhibits to small towns.
The communities came together and made up banners that they could stretch across the road that said, the Smithsonian is here. The Smithsonian is coming.
And when the federal cuts came, she was helping plan an exhibit for 2026 called Voices and Votes, Democracy in America. Like older exhibits, she expects this one to start conversations.
And that is what we need to have. We don't all have to agree, but we do need to talk.
But even an announced donation to the NEH by the philanthropic Mellon Foundation can't undo the federal cuts. And so it's not clear how the Georgia Humanities Council can afford to help those conversations happen. For GPB News, I'm Grant Blankenship in Macon.
And that's it for today's edition of Georgia Today. If you'd like to learn more about these stories, visit gpb.org/news. If you haven't yet hit subscribe on this podcast, take a moment right now and do it. That'll help you to keep us current in your feed. If you have feedback, send that to us at georgiatoday@gpb.org. I'm Orlando Montoya, and we'll be here again for you tomorrow.